It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You've likely seen the ads promoting how stem cell therapies are the answer to seemingly dozens of medical problems. Many of those claims aren't backed necessarily by rigorous research, and that concerns Dr. Peter Rubin. He is the chair of plastic surgery and the co-director of the Adipose Stem Cell Center at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Rubin is here to help us sort out fact from fiction when considering stem cell therapy. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
In the past, you've expressed concern that stem cell therapies were at a pivotal moment, at risk of becoming the snake oil of the modern era. How so?
Well, regenerative therapies and stem cell therapies have a lot of promise. And I want to start by making the point that this is a real field. There's a lot of wonderful federally funded research being done in this area, a lot of great research right here in Pittsburgh. However, because of the easy accessibility of these cells, the easy administration of therapies in a lot of different settings, in many cases, the advertising and the marketing has just gotten ahead of the science. And we're seeing a lot of for-profit clinics popping up all around the country that are offering therapies for which the claims are just not substantiated by solid medical evidence.
Are the advertisers, are the marketers, are they just sort of hopping on that hope that we all have that something can be done for either ourselves or for a loved one?
That's a great point. You know, a real attractive feature of stem cells is that they can offer hope for a cure where other therapies fall short. And there are a lot of people who are really playing on that concept. I've seen stem cell therapies that have been advertised for autism, for different neurologic diseases, for which there is no real basis. I've seen stem cell therapies offered for problems, orthopedic and musculoskeletal problems, that really aren't going to get better without surgery. Mm-hmm. And this is not to say that there aren't therapies in those areas targeting those problems that have validity. However, when you see a clinic advertising a single therapy that is going to treat a multitude of unrelated problems, then that almost seems too good to be true. Mm. And if it seems too good to be true, you have to take a real close look at what's going on and whether this is really valid.
What are some of the risks that patients take when they visit these clinics?
Well, there are two types of risks that patients are going to encounter. The first risk is from the treatment itself. Are these cells going to be free of contaminants? Are they going to be free of disease? Are there going to be other adulterants in the mix that may cause problems or may cause harm? Are the conditions truly sterile and the kind of conditions where we'd want to see these procedures performed? So that's one risk in itself. The second related risk that I would say is almost more important is the risk of not being properly evaluated and treated by a physician who understands the disease process that you are coming into the clinic with. So, for example, there was a case, a very high-profile case of a clinic in Florida that treated several patients who ultimately became blind. And these patients had macular degeneration. This was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that was an area where adipose stem cells were used, but they were used in a way that was not really appropriate for that application. I will advocate that if you want to get the best treatment, start by seeing an expert or a specialist in the area where they are best qualified to treat that disorder or that disease process. They will know if there are new therapies, especially stem cell therapies, that may be effective. And most importantly, they will know where that therapy fits into the landscape of the treatment.
Is the FDA doing anything about these clinics? Should the FDA do anything?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the myths that these stem cell clinics will propagate is that the FDA has no oversight, that they're not regulated by the FDA because they are simply practicing medicine and the FDA doesn't regulate that. In fact, that is not the case. And that argument has been tested in court by stem cell clinics unsuccessfully. The FDA regulates all tissues that come out of the human body and are intended for implantation back into the human body, whether it's the same person or whether it is another individual. So the FDA really does have oversight. They don't have the resources to go around and shut down every clinic and police every clinic. They have a lot of work to do. So they are targeting certain high-profile clinics. Another challenge for the FDA is, how do you separate the promising evolving therapies from the things that don't work and might be dangerous? And in doing so, they've generated some great new legislation related to the 21st Century Cures Act, where they have an RMAT pathway. It's the Regenerative Medicine Advanced Therapy pathway. So the FDA really wants to help us responsibly develop these therapies. And at the same time, they want to make sure that there aren't spurious claims being made by these different clinics.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Dr. Peter Rubin, co-director of the Adipose Stem Cell Center at the University of Pittsburgh. Your research and therapies focus on adult stem cells, specifically yes. Adult fat stem cells. Do these stem cells have any particular advantages over others?
They do. In America especially, we all have a lot of adipose tissue. So we all have a reservoir of these cells. They're very easy to access through minimally invasive procedures, through very, very small incisions. We can use essentially small version liposuction techniques to take some fat out, and then these cells can be processed from the fat. A very advantageous aspect of fat tissue is that we don't necessarily have to take the cells out of the fat tissue to get the effects. We can actually transfer the fat tissue, and that contains a population of these inherent stem cells. And under clinical trials that have been overseen by the FDA, we have also added back in a patient's own stem cells to make a more concentrated mix. They can actually tone down inflammation in areas where we inject them. And they are also potent releasers of growth factors that can assist with the healing process.
Healing what?
One of the applications where we have been using these cells is in patients who have damage to their tissue from radiation, from therapeutic radiation. We see this a lot in cancer patients. Mm-hmm. And what we find is that these cells have what we call an anti-fibrotic effect. They can actually help soften the tissues, bring in a new blood supply to the tissues, and improve the quality and relieve symptoms of tightness and a decreased range of motion. So that's one of the applications. We are just completing a clinical trial that is funded by the Department of Defense, and this is designed to help our wounded warriors.
Right.
A big problem in that population is limb amputations from the IED blast. So we have a tremendous population in our military personnel who have suffered amputations, and many of these patients have pain syndromes at the site of their amputation. It really limits their ability to use a prosthesis, to mobilize, to get up and around and integrate back into the workforce and back into all of their activities. We've been using adipose tissue with adipose stem cells to treat those pain syndromes, and we've had very, very promising results from that study. And these are procedures that are essentially outpatient surgical procedures that are low on the risk scale.
You've mentioned pain. You mentioned anti-inflammatory.
Yes.
Do I understand that the fat stem cells can also be involved in bone growth?
Well, they can. And there's been some very interesting data published out of Europe, where a group in Finland actually used adipose stem cells with specific growth factors to induce new bone growth. And that's been a great area of research. The interesting thing about adult stem cells is when you introduce them into a living system, contrary to what people may think, they don't just wildly turn into different tissue like bone or cartilage or muscle. They tend to stay quiet and release growth factors unless you stimulate them very vigorously with different growth factors to get them to transform into a different tissue type. So when we talk about using stem cells to grow new tissues, to form new tissues, right, we really have to stimulate them in that system, and that involves introducing growth factors and different drugs. So it becomes a little more complex to get there. Most of the uses that you're seeing will involve stem cells to assist in the healing process.
Final question. So what new stem cell therapies, adipose or others, do you see in the next, I don't know, 5-10 years? What are the realistic possibilities? What do you dream of as a goal?
Well, what I dream of is that we are going to be able to really engage the healing powers of our own stem cells in a less invasive manner and in a manner that's more effective. Instead of having to take our own stem cells out and readminister them to get the results, are we able to stimulate these stem cells within the body to become more active and to participate in the healing process? So what I really want to see in the next 5 years is a better understanding of the biology of these cells, the best applications in which we can use them, really understand the mechanisms by which they function, and very importantly, understand how we better signal these cells to activate their healing properties.
Dr. Peter Rubin is the chair of plastic surgery and co-director of the Adipose Stem Cell Center at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Rubin, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Really a pleasure to be here today.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, more than 2,100 musicians play at the Civic Arena in an attempt to break the world record for largest orchestra in 1998. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra coordinated the event, auditioning several thousand students for the performance. The old record was set in 1996 in England. The show lineup included works by Leonard Bernstein, Mozart, and Beethoven. Performers rehearsed regionally, combining for the first time on the morning of the concert. The record would be broken later that fall and is currently held by Germany, who gathered 7,500 musicians in 2017. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Before Pittsburgh became the Steel City, the region was known for glass manufacturing. Jeanette, about 30 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, was once home to 7 glass plants and was known as Glass City. For our Built in PGH series, 90.5 WESA, Sarah Schneider brings us the story of how the last remaining glass producer in Jeanette has remained in business since 1904.
Just feet from where molten glass flows into molds, finished products slide down a belt that cools the glass. At the end of the line, Jeanette Specialty Glass CEO Kathleen Sarniak-Tanzola holds up a thick, clear cylinder. It's a textured lens used in street lighting.
All the prisms are directing light.
The refractor she's holding is one of the products that kept Sarniak-Tanzola's company afloat for decades as nearby glass manufacturers closed. In the early 2000s, factories opened en masse in China that made similar lighting parts from the same type of glass.
We saw over 30% of the business go away. We had to survive.
That's when Sarniak-Tanzola came on board to launch an idea crafted by her late husband.
We called him the mad scientist because he was just, for hours, he would put things together, and he was just a really cool, cool person.
Ted Sarniak's plan to save the business was to make glass sinks. A few styles made with a different type of glass were already on the market, but he thought his borosilicate glass, which is more resistant to temperature change, could better withstand hot water, and that the crystal clear glass he made was more attractive. They began making sinks that sat on top of and within vanities.
Next thing you know, we're doing business and doing serious business. We did close to $2 million within 3 years.
The company's line of kitchen and bath sinks now makes up 20% of its revenue. They're in 2,000 showrooms and sold in 500 Lowe's stores. While other companies hung their hats on one or two products, Ted Sarniak stretched his 50-person shop and pivoted. So did his wife. She left a career in cosmetics marketing to help her husband.
When I first started here, I put the tennis shoes on, the work shoes, and went in the factory and learned every single, from finishing, from production to finishing to shipping to all of it, so that I would understand the business.
Ted died suddenly from a heart attack in 2012, and Kathleen stayed on board as CEO. Since Sarniak's death, the company has created 7 more sink designs, including its bestseller, Cubix.
Cubix is a cubed pattern that just keeps repeating itself over and over and over and over again, so it looks a little bit more industrial.
She's spotted her sinks in restaurants, salons, and even reality TV shows.
I remember once there was a bachelor scene, and he is standing at the mirror, and he's primping himself for his date that evening, and there's our sinks. It's just fun.
The past 3 years have been the most profitable since Ted Sarniak bought the business out of bankruptcy in 1976.
Teddy could turn a penny into a dollar and a dollar into five and five into 10. Who knows what makes someone entrepreneurial and someone else not? It's the spirit, and Teddy always had it. And he's taught it to me, he's taught it to his son, and it's catchy.
Her son, Ted the Fourth, who is the company's general manager, came up with the newest products for two industries Sarniak Tanzola says will never be in recession.
Pets. Americans love their pets. And we all have to die. So we make urns now for both the pet industry and human industry.
A line of glass pet dishes launched last month. The urns are still in development. Besides staying ahead of the competition, Sarniak Tanzola has faced plenty of other challenges. The factory's furnace runs on gas and oxygen. Prices for those utilities fluctuate constantly. She's also had to figure out a new apprenticeship model as her workforce ages. She calls herself a disruptor as she finds ways to remain profitable.
This company does not need me. There's a lot of great people here, and it will always be here. Lasted 115 years, it'll last another.
I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 11 McKeesport area high school students sued their district and its superintendent last week. The federal suit was filed by the ACLU, and it says the district blocked the creation of a black student union. The club is meant to celebrate black culture and history. Its members also want to explore racial disparities in school discipline. District Superintendent Mark Holtzman, meanwhile, has encouraged white and black students to form a new club. Holtzman says the new group is meant to be more inclusive. 90.5 WESA's Anley Herring spoke with 3 students who want to form the Black Student Union.
Tell me who each of you are and how old are you?
I'm Grace Walker and I'm 15.
I'm Rosada Webb and I'm 15.
I'm Tanasia Bowling and I'm 15.
Do you think there's been any misunderstanding outside of your circle or the Black Student Union about what's really going on here?
Yes. Like, some people think we're doing it for, like, the wrong reasons, like, if that makes sense.
What would the wrong reasons be?
Like, people say that we're making this group to, like, talk about white people and bash them. And some people said that if we make this group, we're just going to tear everything apart and ruin the school, and then if we make this, like, this club, white people is going to want to make a white student union, and it's just going to divide the whole school up.
What would the group do?
White people can join the group. I don't think it would divide our school, only because so many, like, white and black people are, like, close friends. So, like, I feel like this group would help more they divide.
So Dr. Holtzman called 15 students mm-hmm. over the PA system to try to form a new group that he said would be for all students mm-hmm. after you had proposed the Black Student Union and hadn't gotten approval for that yet. And Grace, you were at that meeting with the 15 students. What happened?
So basically first he brought up how he wanted to give everyone a chance in the school to like bring us together. And he was talking about how he wanted a group, or he didn't care what we would name it. And so then he brought up me and he was like, Grace, you were at the student board meeting. Y'all were thinking about a Black Student Union Club. I was like, yeah. So like I was the only one in the whole 15 people who wanted this club. So like everyone was like, well, we don't need it. They don't want to bring everyone apart. And Mr. Holtzman, someone asked what made him change his mind. And he said the trial of Antoine Rose made him change his mind. That's what he told everyone.
Made him have reservations about yeah. permitting a Black student union.
Yeah, that's what he told us.
And he didn't elaborate beyond that.
Mm-mm.
And Rosanna, you were at the second meeting?
Yes.
Who was in the group? It was just you two, Rosanna and Grace from the Black Student Union. Was there anyone else from the Black Student Union?
No.
Who else was there?
There's like four That's it. Black kids.
There's four black kids. The rest are white. The question came up that it was like, what are we going to be called? And he was like, the Black Student Union. The senior. Yeah, the senior. He was like, that it should be called. Well, he didn't say what it should be called, but he was like, Dr. Holtzman said that people in this group wanted a Black Student Union. And then he said, but I'm not black. So, and then everybody just started laughing, and we were just like, all right. And then they made it the McKeesport Student Union.
What? How big was the original group?
Four.
And Rosanna and Grace, you both were part of that?
Yes.
Were you, Tynesha?
No, not at the time.
Why did you decide to join eventually?
The meetings they were having at school that Dr. Holtzman put together, Grace would tell me about them, like in lunch or something. And I think that the voice wasn't really being heard about what they really wanted. And I wanted to be a part of that.
So the effort to create the McKeesport Student Union, which was initiated by Dr. Holtzman, motivated you to join the Black Student Union.
Yeah, I just don't get, if the McKeesport Student Union is a club, then there's no problem with that.
Yeah.
That I'm still trying to figure out why the Black Student Union isn't together. Like, they called us down for a meeting for the McKeesport Student Union or whatever. That's one meeting. Like, nothing before, nothing prior to that meeting. It just happened, and it was a club automatically. But the Black Student Union, on the other hand, is still pending. I just don't understand that.
You said that there's kind of been a divided response to this within the student
yes.
body. Have you found that it tends to be Black students who are more supportive or white students? Does it fall along racial lines or?
Sometimes it tends to be more Black students who are more supportive because they like get it. Like some, they follow up on news and stuff. Well, some do, but yeah.
It depends who
it is.
Some
yeah.
white people I
some people
talk to want to do it.
Yeah.
But some Black people that we talk to don't think that we should have it.
Yeah, some seem scared. Well, people...
They seem scared to
yeah.
get involved, basically. But, I mean, I think they would join it when it's passed. I think they're scared
yeah.
to join it
now
because
there's so much going on.
Yeah,
yeah,
they don't want nothing to jeopardize.
I'm curious to know, what have you learned so far from this whole experience? So, Tynesha, why don't you start?
So far I learned that a lot of people don't get a lot of things that we go through, like they don't, and some people don't want to get it. They don't want to hear about it. That's probably one of the reasons why they're trying to shut it down, not talk about anything. That's why I think we should have a Black Student Union to talk about everything.
Do you worry? I mean, the disparities in discipline were a reason to start this group. Do you personally worry, and I'll stick with you, Rosanna, that you are becoming more of a target from authority figures within the school?
Oh yeah, most definitely.
And that hasn't stopped you?
No.
Why?
Because it's not really, I mean, I'm not scared, but like, if you don't do it, then there's not going to be change.
That's 90.5 WESA's Anlie Herring speaking with Tynasia Bowling, Grace Walker, and Rosanna Webb. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette won a Pulitzer Prize this week in the breaking news category for its coverage of the Tree of Life synagogue shooting. The judges said the paper's coverage, quote, captured the anguish and resilience of a community thrust into grief. Joining us now is David Shribman, the former executive editor of the Post-Gazette, who led the paper's coverage of that horrific event. David, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, I'm happy to do that.
David, so how did you feel when you heard the news that your team won the Pulitzer?
Well, it was a mix of delight and joy, ecstasy actually, tinged with sadness, because we did this work in the hardest circumstances about a tragedy involving our neighbors, my neighbors in particular. I live 3 blocks from there. And you don't want to profit in any way from someone's distress, from tragedy, and from death. So it was hard to process it all, and you felt, I think I said this to our staff, that not one of us would hesitate to exchange that Pulitzer Prize for the lives of those 11 people. And I think we're sobered, even as we are delighted that our work was recognized. But, you know, it's our work. It's what we do. And we're just sad that we had to do this work.
How did you organize your coverage, especially in the early minutes, the early hours, when so little was really known at that point?
Well, you know, we know how to do this kind of work. Our staff rolled in. No one had to call anybody. People just showed up. They showed up to do their work. They showed up to help in any way. We did what we always do, and then we sat down and figured out how to present it both on the web, which actually, you know, was going on in real time, and then in the next day's paper, how to make a statement about this in the next day's paper, which was a Sunday paper. And we came up, actually, I did with the, I think it was the headline, was Squirrel Hill Massacre. I wanted in 3 words to say everything. These were shots heard around the world, and we were here to be witnesses.
As the leader of the newsroom, how do you support your reporters' good work while still being respectful of their feelings? As Pittsburghers, you live near the synagogue.
Well, many of us did. You know, the local editor, Lillian Thomas's physician, was killed. One of our editors' mother's two friends were killed. Another fellow lives not far from there. Several of us do. I would have kind of a homily every day in which I would talk about what our purpose was, how we were supposed to do this work, how it was our duty. And I came to think of this as we were supposed to speak to Pittsburgh, but then more generally we were supposed to speak for Pittsburgh, and that we had to make a statement for Pittsburgh and for the remarkable response of Pittsburghers. You know, we won a Pulitzer Prize for how we responded, but there's no Pulitzer Prize, sad to say, for the public's response, which was remarkable. And if you remember, surely remember, and your listeners will remember, how people poured into the streets in Squirrel Hill and elsewhere, how people of all faiths got together. And we also thought that our job was to convey that so the world knew what kind of place this was.
Why is it important for Pulitzer and other award committees to recognize breaking news journalism, specifically when it's something that almost by definition every news outlet does every day?
Well, I don't know. I think more generally this year's Pulitzers recognized the importance of local news at a time when local news is more in danger than ever, when our democracy depends more than ever on the press, when our political system and our and our civilization, the way our society and culture depends more and more on endangered species. When the phrase fake news is in the air, it's all the more important for us to assert that we do our work without fear or favor. We do it often with courage, I hope always with compassion, and always with integrity.
David, is there a way that the PG could honor those killed with this award?
Oh, I don't know. I think we try to honor them every day, and we do with our every day with our work. There are some acts that are so horrible that there is no consolation. No consolation notes ever suffice. We wrote our consolation notes in boldface type, sometimes 72-point type, and we did the best we could in those circumstances. This community still mourns. One drives by the Tree of Life with trepidation and with deep respect. I think the best way to honor the dead is to continue that respect and to drive carefully and respectfully past that tragic corner.
Tree of Life shooting was in October. You left a paper earlier this year. What are your hopes for your Post-Gazette colleagues and your city in the days, the weeks ahead?
Well, you know, I'm a Post-Gazetter, and I always used to say when others left that in the fraternity of the Post-Gazette, there is no parting. And so I'm rooting for them every single day. Of course, I get the paper. I read it carefully with affection and attention.
David Shribman is the former executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He led the team that won a Pulitzer Prize this week for breaking news journalism covering the Tree of Life shooting in October. David, congratulations to you and your team, and thanks for all of your journalistic contributions through the years.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, President Trump went to Texas. He signed two executive orders dealing with the oil and gas industries. One does not really affect Pennsylvania's energy industry. The other does. Joining me in studio is reporter Amy Sisk, who covers energy for WESA and State Impact Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the show, Amy.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Pennsylvania produces natural gas. This executive order from President Trump would make it easier to transport that gas out of state. Sounds like a good deal for the industry, but is there a but?
Yes. So the natural gas industry in Pennsylvania definitely welcomed this executive order, and it would do a couple of things that would affect Pennsylvania, one of which is that it would propose some changes to how states permit pipelines under the Clean Water Act, and it would also direct the Federal Department of Transportation to create a rule allowing natural gas to be transported by trains. And I suspect that both of those proposals are going to be pretty controversial among environmentalists and among some states.
Well, one of the issues that you just raised that the president wants to address surrounds a pipeline, and it's the Constitution pipeline that would run from Pennsylvania to New York.
We need help with New York. New York is hurting the country because they're not allowing us to get those pipelines through, and that's why they're paying so much for their heating and all of the things that energy and our energy produces.
All right. So I mentioned New York, Pennsylvania. Where specifically would this pipeline run, and what's the status of it?
Yeah, so the Constitution pipeline was first proposed several years ago. It would be 120 miles of a pipeline that would begin in Susquehanna County in the northeastern part of Pennsylvania and run north into New York. It was proposed by the lead developer on the project is a company called Williams. But this pipeline was proposed and it has yet to be built because it's hit some snags receiving all of its necessary permits to be built, particularly from New York.
Susquehanna County, definitely the heart of Marcellus Shale gas production, is it not?
It is, yeah. The two biggest gas-producing parts of Pennsylvania are the northeastern part of the state where Susquehanna County is, and then here in southwestern Pennsylvania in Greene and Washington counties.
And this Constitution pipeline would carry natural gas from there, from Marcellus Shale gas, right?
Correct, yes, from Susquehanna County up into New York where it could be used in New York and throughout the northeastern part of the United States.
So how much of a demand is there for, I guess, cheaper natural gas in the Northeast?
There is a demand up there because the northeastern part of the country is not a place that produces its own natural gas. So it has to rely on gas from other parts of the country, such as Pennsylvania. And the natural gas industry here in Pennsylvania has talked for a long time about wanting to build new pipelines to get Pennsylvania gas to market to places like the Northeast. And so people in the Northeast, they tend to use a variety of fuels to heat their homes. Some of them use natural gas. Some of them use electricity. Wood and heating oil is a big one in the northeastern part of the country. And because of that, home heating prices tend to be a little bit more expensive in the New England area because natural gas is generally considered like the cheapest way to heat a home, and they don't have as big of a supply up there.
All right. So why specifically the holdup in building this pipeline?
Yep. So in 2016, the state of New York denied this key water quality permit to the Constitution Pipeline, and it's granted the authority to give those permits under the Clean Water Act. Because of that, that's effectively stalled this project, and it's been caught up in court battles and regulatory battles ever since. Mm-hmm.
You say it hasn't been started yet, but at the Pennsylvania end, are there any challenges to the project?
So it hasn't faced the same sorts of permitting challenges in Pennsylvania, but State Impact Pennsylvania has reported on a family that lives up in the northeastern part of the state that owns land where this pipeline is slated to go through. And they've actually launched a legal battle because pipeline construction workers went in and cut down, I believe it was 500 trees to make room for this pipeline before the project received all of its necessary permits. And they're saying, well, we're not sure that this pipeline is ever going to be built.
So how would the executive order affect the pipeline? Reduced regulations, less stringent permitting process? What?
Yeah, so President Trump is proposing that the EPA issue new guidance to states as well as a new rule that would change the way that states permit these pipelines given their water quality right. permits. But it's unclear exactly what sort of changes are going to be in this final rule, because this executive order was short on some specifics, but it did say that President Trump wants timely federal-state cooperation.
Okay. We have less than 2 minutes left. I want to get to another aspect of that executive order having to deal with shipping gas out, and this is above ground.
Yes. So President Trump is proposing that his Department of Transportation issue a rule that would allow natural gas to be transported by train. So here in Pittsburgh, every single day we see trains with these big black tank cars on them. And that's carrying oil probably from North Dakota, could be from Canada as well. And those roll through town every day. So President Trump is proposing to do something similar with natural gas. And the way that you do that is you take natural gas and you have to cool it to, I believe it's negative 260 degrees Fahrenheit, so that it turns into a liquid form. You can load it into tank cars, and then it could be transported to wherever it needs to go.
And are there any safety concerns with transporting it that way?
Yes, there are. We've seen derailments of oil trains. And although those are pretty rare, they can be catastrophic. And I always think back to 2013. There was a oil train crash up in Canada that actually killed 47 people. So if this is comes to fruition with natural gas, I expect that we're going to see some similar concerns.
All right. Just about 20 seconds left. Several of the president's executive orders on a variety of issues have been challenged in the courts. Anything about these orders that they might be challenged?
I suspect that they will. And in fact, New York's governor has already said that he plans to challenge this and fight it.
All right. Amy Sisk reports on energy for WESA as well as State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks as always, Amy.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, he's the only actor who has performed in all 10 plays in August Wilson's American Century Cycle, each set in a different decade of the 20th century, as well as the Pulitzer Prize winner's one-man autobiographical show, How I Learned What I Learned. We'll have a conversation with actor Wally Jamal. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.